to play in the Super Bowl against the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Vernon hands the Lynch left side. Finds a little bit of a hole. Keeps his leg moving. He's across the 40. Midfield. 45. He's on the run, Lynch. 40. Pushes him at 35. Look at him go. He's down to 20. 15. He could go. He is going to go. Touchdown, Seahawks. Oh, my word. A 67-yard run. Marshawn Lynch. Unbelievable. The beast is alive and well.
Wide receivers to either side. Russell takes the snap. He drops back.
To the middle. It's intercepted. Going the other way. He's out across the 30, the 40, midfield, down the far sideline. Is he going to outrun everybody? He is. It's Bobby Wagner from the goal line. 99 yards. He lays down in the end zone. Somebody bring him oxygen.
It has been decided maybe since the safety in the first quarter. 12, they're bringing the trophy home. Your Seahawks Super Bowl 48 champion.
Ladies and gentlemen, Seahawks and football fans everywhere, a very warm welcome back to the We Talk Seahawks podcast. I hope you're all doing well. Seahawks played this weekend. I can't really remember who they played against because I didn't see an awful lot of them. Were we playing another team? Was it the Giants? Mitch,
I think it was the Giants.
I think it was 24-3 or something like that. But I don't really remember seeing much of the other teams. But it kind of felt like we were just playing against Casper's ghost. So I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I'm sure you all did as well. 24-3. My word. How about that Seahawks defense at the offense on a night where the offense needs a bit of slack picking up. They need bailing out a little bit, which is usually the other way around. But for the first time this season, other than maybe the Rams game, but the defense was also pretty crap in that game too. The offense says to the defense, come and win us a game. Come and bail us out, will you? And what do the defense do? They go and get 11 sacks and all the rest in between, all the fun stuff in between that we're going to get into. But yeah, man, what a performance. The Seahawks are 3-1 into the bye week now. Looking ahead to that big, big game against the Bengals after the bye week. Will it be Joe Burrow? Will it not? But whoever it will be, the Seahawks are putting themselves in a fantastic position for early seeding and playoff implications in the NFC. I honestly can't wait to get into this Seahawks performance tonight because it was pretty special. It's my favorite game of the season so far. I'm sure it's pretty much all of yours as well. But Mitch, how are you, mate?
I'm very good. Predictably very good after a week like that in the NFL. We saw a pretty average offensive line for the Giants, you'd say. Get absolutely torn to ribbons by pretty much any one of our defensive players that decided to blitz, and I'm all for it.
Yeah, it was. I'd almost be embarrassed if I was a Seahawks defender and I didn't get a sack in that Giants game because I mean everyone and their mum got a sack for the Seahawks, or everyone and their mum got a play of some note for the Seahawks. I mean, it was just everyone on that defense just feasted on that Giants offense and that Giants offensive line, which we're going to get into. Pez can't be with us tonight. He is apparently packing to go to Amsterdam tomorrow. He's obviously getting on the good stuff because he's off to celebrate some good Seahawks performance or to maybe sort of drown his sorrows or spliff his sorrows away that the fact that Jackson Smith and Jigba still isn't being used in the Seahawks offense. Either way, I'm sure he's going to have a great time in Amsterdam, but understandably can't be with us tonight. But we are going to crack on. We're going to start with the offense, and we're probably not going to spend, well, for right or wrong, we might spend a bit more time on the offense than maybe you'd think, because it was a pretty poor performance from the offense, I must say. Put it this way, Mitch. The Seahawks got 13 first downs. The Giants got 17. And yet the Giants scored 3 points and we got 24. And yet they got considerably more first downs than the Seahawks offense, which is just, it was just a really weird offensive performance. Geno Smith, 13 for 20 for 110 yards passing and a touchdown. Obviously had to leave the game for a certain point due to a knee injury, but it looks like everything's okay with him. And then Drew Lock came into the game and pretty much half Geno Smith's yardage on six attempts. Two were completed. Obviously that one big monster one for Noah Fant for 63 yards. Yeah, it was a really weird game for the offense. I don't really know what happened. Again, you've got the offensive line sort of banged up that we know we've got with Charles Cross and Abe Lucas out there, and Storm Forsyth and Curran having to come in. But I don't know, that hadn't stopped us last week, and then this week, I didn't expect it to stop us again. And for whatever reason, that the offense just was not firing. It just wasn't clicking. It just wasn't working. The ground game was Ken Walker again, 17 carries, 79 yards and a touchdown. I mean, just absolute lead back numbers all the way, workhorse as he is. He picked up the slack, but other than that, like I say, Noah Fant leading the receptions with 63 yards, Tyler Lockett coming in second with 54, DK Metcalf being held for just 34 yards. Jackson Smith and Jigba, three receptions for 5 yards, almost more receptions than yards. Just a really, really weird, really weird offensive performance that I just don't really know. I don't know how to sum it up. I don't know where to go with it, because I just don't know what happened. I can't present a conclusive reason for what happened. It was just a really off night. I don't know whether you, with your expert eyes, Mitch, found anything that I couldn't see, but it just seemed like for whatever reason, the offense just met its match a little bit with that Giants front line, even though they didn't dominate. That's what I'm saying. Like, it didn't feel like the Giants front seven dominated our offensive line, but they obviously did something, the Giants defense, in that game to stop the offense from working. Do you have any idea what it was?
Nothing conclusive necessarily, but what one thing I would say is that an enormous difference between the Giants quarterback and the Seahawks quarterback is that only one of those values ball security.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I think Jones in general has had a lot of fumbling issues, but that night we saw two very bad interceptions from a quarterback standpoint. The one to Devin Witherspoon. Devin Witherspoon's done very well, but at the same time, he's not remembered the wide receiver's route being a comeback route, and he's thrown it where he was going, the direction that the wide receiver was running, instead of where he was going to stop and turn and come back to complete. So that was terrible. And the one to Diggs, I don't know what he sees. It almost looks like he thought Diggs had a Giants shirt on, because it was that terrible. We see Geno some games marching the ball up the field quite well when he's supported by the run game. And some games we see him not taking chances on what looked like open receivers when we've got a chance to carry on marching the ball down the field. However, I do value his high level of accuracy, combined with his heightened sort of importance on ball security. It looked a bit dysfunctional. We only saw two tight end catches in the whole game, and both of them were to Fant. We saw targets for Disley that didn't get there. There was the one that was sidearmed, I think, that nearly got intercepted by Thibodeau, I think, was aimed at a tight end. Mm-hmm. And there was one that was aimed at Disley, which was the one where it got batted back and he caught his own reception and then ran to the sideline, and that bulldog from behind on the outside, the play that hurt Geno happened as a result of that. So there were targets for the tight ends that didn't happen for those reasons, and there were targets for Jackson Smith and Jigba, who had a drop. I think that might have been Locke that threw that. And there was also one for Charbonnet on an out route, where the ball was thrown slightly behind him, and he's reached backwards to take the catch. And in reaching backwards rather than in front of him, has reached back towards the defender, and the defender's managed to get a hand on it and take it out. So there's drop. There's the Jackson Smith and Jigba drop is kind of on him. It was tough. The targets for Disley and one for Parkinson were batted down, and the one for Charbonnet, as I say, was technically a pass defensed. So there were targets for some of the players that didn't seem to get many targets or didn't get much action. There were targets for them that just didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a couple of sacks on him as well. Jake Curran had a difficult night with Thibodeau, and so they did disrupt us with you know, when you think about all the passes that were batted down, nearly intercepted, the couple of sacks, the passes defensed on Charbonnet. As soon as you start to factor that in, they did stop some of our offense. They did manage to stop some of our offense. Mm-hmm. They had a far tougher time stopping our defense.
Yes, they did.
and our special teams. But they did interact. They did manage to make Gino's life a little bit difficult. The fact that we had to swap quarterbacks due to an injury as well meant they were getting to him. So I give the Giants credit for giving Gino a test.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, Thibodeau's a really talented player. Two sacks for him. You can see why he was taken in the first round. Very versatile weapon that you've got to account for. And yeah, he's going to give most offensive lines problems. For me, like we've said all kind of season, certainly in the preseason, one of my big things that I kept kind of saying is that I feel more confident and more comfortable with this year's version of Drew Lock than last year's version of Drew Lock. I thought he looked a better quarterback in the preseason. He looked like he'd gone away and improved on not turning the ball over, being more accurate, being more kind of responsible with the football. And I thought 2 for 6 looks a bit harsh on him. Like you say, that Jackson Smith and Jigba one, I've got to be honest, I thought Jackson Smith and Jigba as a first round pick maybe should be catching that ball. It wasn't a perfect ball, but it was certainly should have been within his radius, and he hasn't made it in. Maybe that's just a confidence thing, and because of the lack of balls that he is being able to catch at the minute, he's just his hands are a bit cold in that kind of regard. So I thought 2 for 6 looked a little bit harsh on him, but that fan, well, it that throw to Fant, I should say. It was let's have it right. It was mainly Noah Fant getting him those 63 yards due to his unbelievable footwork down the sidelines. But what did we make of Drew Lock in terms of what we saw from when we came in? Because I think my takeaway is, before I hand it to you, is that if in the future, this season, if this needs to happen again, I have enough confidence in Drew Lock and the way that we are going to use Drew Lock and the things that we're going to ask him to do, I'm confident enough that Drew Lock will keep us in games. It's not going to be a position where Drew Lock comes in and we all as Seahawks fans sit there watching it go, oh, well, that's the game then. If we're trailing or if we're losing, you know, that we all turn around and go, oh, well, that's game over then, because Drew Lock's in. He's not going to be able to keep us in the game. I look at him and think, you know what, he's one of these, he's Tyler Heinicke. He's one of those kind of quarterbacks that can come into a game and it doesn't mean that the game's over when he's in. He can still put you in positions and put the offense in positions to win games and score points. That's what he looked like to me. I don't know whether you agree.
Yeah, there's a few things I'd say on this. Coming into the season, I'd have said that Gino has a better deep ball. I'd say that was one thing he'd have over him. But we've seen so far this year, Gino hasn't been able to do, you know, perform that trick. So that's one advantage that seems to have been scratched off. I thought Drew Lock looked a real handy weapon with his legs. You know, one of the first things he did was snap off a first down. I think it was 8 or 9 yards to collect a first down as well, which looked as good, if not better, than the way Gino's been doing it. So in terms of mobility, in terms of the deep ball, I don't think we lose anything at all. What Gino does have, which Lock does not have in my eyes, is the ball placement. You know, hitting the numbers, putting the ball where defenders can't get a hand on it, you know, trying to give as many advantages as possible to the receivers and take those advantages away from defenders. Gino does that quite well. And I think when you looked at the way Lock was spraying the ball around, it was a bit loose. And that might be a little bit harsh because he's literally not played and then he's come in and mid-game. It's not like he had the, it's not like he knew he was starting today because of an injury and he could warm up properly, you know, thinking he's playing and get his head right. It was just right off you go and, you know, go and do what you can. So in that respect, I might be being a little bit harsh, but I think Gino has that over him, the ball placement and things. So it's a marginal thing for Gino. The big thing that Gino has that Locke doesn't have as well, the really big one, I think, is that ball security and not getting the rushes of blood to the head that Locke's had. Maybe Locke has removed that from his game, but we won't see it until we're forced to see it. Mm-hmm. So until we're in that position, I'd happily just assume that Gino is better in that regard. Gino seems to have really matured with the starting role. And I'd hope in a situation where Locke came into the fold, if he was there for, say, the remaining season because of a season ender for Gino, or a few games out and he played a few games in a row, I'd like to think they would put Locke in a position where he doesn't take too much risks. He prioritizes the run game, takes the short completions, tries to march the ball steadily down the field, and then use the deep ball if it presents. I don't think we want to be putting Locke in a position where the whole playbook's open to him and he can start slinging it at this point. If he's in there, I'd like to see us lean on the running game, lean on the tight ends, try and get Njigba involved short, you know, and then hit DK and Tyler down the field. If you restrict him to that, I think he can operate that. And also, I would say this, if they can give a restricted playbook to Drew Locke and lean on the running game, and then the defense plays like it played this week, you can still be a championship side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
genuinely.
I'd agree with that totally. I'm going to transition to Ken Walker because I want to get through this offense as quick as we can, because there's just so much to pack in on this defense, so many people to highlight, and that is the real story of this game. But Ken Walker, we can't not say anything on him. 17 carries, 79 yards, 4.6 average, and that little 1 yard touchdown from the goal line. Do you know what it is for me? This game summed up why you pay running backs in the NFL and why the running backs are so keen to get their point across as to why they deserve their bag when the time comes. When offenses, certainly passing games, break down and don't work, if you don't then have a running game to lean on and bail you out, that's when offenses just completely crumble. Whereas we were able to show that, okay, our passing game wasn't working as well as it is that, you know, that we're normally used to seeing. So what can we do when that's not working? We can go and lean on Ken Walker to go and have 17 carries, have a 79-yard game and get a touchdown for us and keep our offense somewhat moving on the ground when it's not moving in the air. The Giants, obviously Saquon's not there. Matt Breida has to come in. Matt Breida, with all due respect, isn't a Ken Walker. He's a running back three, running back two at best in the NFL. So when the Giants' passing game inevitably broke down against our secondary, because Daniel Jones is pretty shit, to put it kindly, and to put it kindly as well, their receivers are pretty shit. They don't have a running back to lean on, and the running game can't pick up the slack, and this game shows you the value of the running back. If you don't understand the value of a running back in the NFL and having a good running back and a good running game in the NFL in general, this game is a perfect highlight. Seahawks showed you why it's massively important to have one. The Giants are showing you why it's massively important that you when you have one, you keep them around, because that offense without Saquon Barkley, I mean, Saquon is their entire offense. And he showed that. And Saquon will be the most happy Giants player on the Giants roster at the minute, because he's proving his point. He's proving the running backs as a wider committee's point to the NFL, to the NFL fans, that, look, this is how important we are. This is our value, because that Giants offense was nothing without Saquon Barkley and their running back. And our offense was everything with Ken Walker when it wasn't working through the air. So massive, massive props to Ken. I mean, this kid is just, he could be anything he wants. He could be he will be a top five running back in the NFL for the large proportion of his prime of his career. Obviously, new talent comes in every year, but I mean, seriously, this he just shines every week. He just shines every week, even when we're not great. If anyone shines on the offense, it's just always, he always shines. Even in our sort of dampest days on offense, he's such a star. So any thoughts on Ken from that game before we move on to the defense?
Yeah, I mean, I'll briefly touch on it. I thought it was probably his least effective game of the season so far, and it was still good.
And he still went for 79.
It was still good. Yeah, that's the thing. Like you say, even on your worst day, if you're that competitive, even on your worst day, you are genuinely a star. And he's really started to see the game at a speed that allows him to make adjustments, reassess, and attack. It's almost like a quarterback having reads to progress through. It's like he seems to just see multiple different options for him to attack and cycle through them, and doors seem to get shut in his face sometimes by defenders, and he just go to the next door, you know. And it's a very fun thing to watch. And sometimes he takes it to the house, sometimes he rips off the 20-30 yards, sometimes he gets five when he probably should have lost a few. So I'm loving to watch it at the moment. I think he's, like you say, he's superb. And I think the backup job that's being done by Charbonnet is really allowing him to come on the field fresh every time. This time last year, he was being asked to play with an injury, and there were games where he looked a little bit absent, or, you know, he didn't look fresh, or he was a bit haggard. Every time he steps on the field at the moment, he's fresh as a daisy, and it's because Charbonnet's doing some of the hard yards for him, and Charbonnet himself is just as exciting doing them. So it's a joy to watch, even on a bad offensive display. Both of them really turned up, so I'm really happy with that situation.
Yeah, like we say, them two as a 1-2 punch are an absolute force to be reckoned with for many years to come, and they will continue to carry our offense when it needs to be carried.
On that subject, actually, before we move on, are you aware that there's potential changes to the collective bargaining agreement with running backs? So when they entered the NFL, the idea is they would get a year less on their contract than other positions, meaning that the year that they end up negotiating a new deal with their team or being traded to a different team to sign a new contract would come that year earlier, meaning that teams signing a running back to their second year would be negotiating with them at the ages of 24, 25, meaning that they could sign a new deal and be playing for a team until 28, 29. Whereas at the moment, nobody is signing a 27-year-old running back to more than a year or two, which I think is giving shorter careers to running backs. I think, one, we're very lucky to have got Charbonnet and Ken Walker before that, honestly. And two, I think it's a superb initiative because they have the shortest shelf life of any position in the NFL. And if we want that position to be attractive to players in college, so that some of the best athletes are honing their craft at that position and keeping the NFL exciting, I think there does need to be a carrot dangled. Especially if you're a running back being taken by a less competitive team. You know, if you're a running back, you might think, well, I might go to a horrible team, but I only have to be there for three seasons, and then I can be on the trade block and off to the Chiefs or the Eagles, or, you know. I think it's genius, and I think it will really, really solve the issue with running backs and their, you know, and their pay.
Interesting. I had not I'd not seen that. So that is an interesting outlook on potentially the future of that position. Like you say, thankfully, we're not going to have to worry about that hopefully for the next few years with Ken and Zach.
Yeah.
But
it's almost like Pete knew it was coming and picked that another second round running back before it happened. Maybe, and everyone was complaining about it. Yeah. Pete knows best. In Pete we trust.
Defense. Here we are. We've got to them. I've got to start by normally I go through each player individually, but I'm going to give a props to the entire defense to start with. 11 sacks, 2 interceptions, 3 points allowed, obviously, and 4 different players with multiple sacks. I don't know when that's ever happened in a Seahawks game before. Just ridiculous. Bobby Wagner with 2 sacks, Devin Witherspoon obviously with 2 sacks and the interception, and what an interception it was. Jordan Brooks with 2 sacks, Uchenna Nwosu with 2 sacks, Super Mario with a sack, Miles Adams with a sack, Boye Mafe with a sack, and obviously Quandre Diggs with the interception as well. We've got to start with Devin Witherspoon. Like I say, we always try and start on the D-line, but he's just the talk of the town. He's the talk of the NFL now because he's showed out on prime time. 97-yard pick 6, 2 sacks, 3 quarterback hits as well, 7 tackles. I mean, but Mitch... Jalen Carter. You know what I mean? Can I just check? Jalen Carter's got 8 tackles, 1.5 sacks, 0 pass breakups so far this season. Devin Witherspoon has 21 tackles, 2 sacks, and 3 pass breakups. So he's got more sacks than Jalen Carter he has this season. He's got more tackles. But you know, we can't. I don't know if you were like me, Mitch, but when that pick 6 went in, I wasn't happy at all because that should have been Jalen Carter out there. You know what I mean? It's a void pick 6. He shouldn't be out there.
And I'll add to this, right? I worked this out and put this on Twitter earlier today. Currently, Devin Witherspoon, after his 3 games, right, puts him on a projection for the season of, right, are you ready for this?
Oh, yeah.
130 tackles.
Fuck.
23 passes defensed, 12 sacks, 6 interceptions, and that's just based on 3 games. That, I mean, I know we don't get to play the Giants every week, and we need to remember that, mm-hmm. or the Panthers. But that is some going. And also, the other thing is, he was undermined in preseason by holding out on his contract and then the hamstring niggle and people wondering whether he was going to be injury prone all of his career. I'd like to point out that in the 3 games he's been fit for, he's played 100% of the defensive snaps.
There you go.
In 2 different positions.
Mm-hmm. But he's the first Seahawks cornerback ever to have 2 sacks in a game.
2 sacks and a pick 6, right? I think was the stat. Is that right? Or was it 2 picks?
I think it was just 2 sacks. The first first Seahawks
Cornerback to ever have 2 sacks. I'm mixing up 2 stats. So it was the first Seahawks player to get... Sorry, first Seahawks cornerback to get 2 sacks.
Yep.
But it was the first... Or the second... No, the first time in NFL history that a defensive back had a pick 6 and 2 sacks in a game. So he has his own NFL first in his rookie season. Which is a superb one too.
Just ridiculous. I mean, like I say, it's surely no one will still be caught up on the Lions thing, but like, he's just proven every week how good he is, why he was taken at number 5. Like I say, that pick 6. Yes, it was a bad throw by Daniel Jones, but it's a very, very smart IQ jumping around from Devin Witherspoon. He knew, like you said, mm-hmm. he knows exactly what Daniel Jones is doing, knows that he's going to stare down his primary receiver, and he jumps it and he takes it to the house. Julian Love showed some burners on that return as well, by the way. Madden need to up his speed. He came flying out of nowhere like, I want to be on the camera.
It was almost like he used to play for the Giants, yeah. and he wanted to have some kind of say in their
misery.
Yeah. So he wanted to get a block for that pick 6.
It just made sure like that Giants fans could see him on the TV doing something and helping out, going, oh, this is me. But yeah, no, I love it.
Did you see his comment post game about that, when they clocked Devin Witherspoon at 20 miles an hour, and they on that return, and they clocked Tariq they clocked Reek at 22.25 miles an hour, which is the fastest anyone had run this season in the NFL. And Jordan Love didn't get a shout out, but he was keeping up with both of them. And he was trying to make the point that at one point he'd gone past Witherspoon, so he was somewhere in between the two. So there was kind of a little street race going on there between the three of them on that return, which I particularly enjoyed.
Brilliant. Oh, just brilliant. Like I say, Reek didn't really sort of no flash points for him in the game, but has played another excellent game, locking down his side. Let's give our props as well to Quandre Diggs for that interception. Just doing stuff that he always does. Doesn't come down and get sacks or anything like that, but just holds the fort down in that free safety role as he always does. And he loves those overthrown picks. He's a master at picking overthrown balls. He just like, I know it's a general thing with free, because you know quarterbacks are trying to hit guys.
That's where they are. Yeah.
That's where they are. But it seems like he's just got a knack for just finding the overthrown ball, finding the loose ball, and just taking advantage of it. And Daniel Jones threw him a gimme, and he gets the pick. But man, this secondary, and it's why we get so frustrated with this defense at times, when they're giving up yards and giving up points, because we just know how talented they are, and it's just such a shame at times to see them either being misused or sitting off teams. And you saw it. It's almost like they listen to this podcast, as we always joke around. But we said that, you know, let's just see our corners. Let's see Devin Witherspoon getting up there and being aggressive. Let's see Reek getting up there and being aggressive instead of playing softer coverages. Just why put a saddle on a Ferrari? And you've got one in Devin Witherspoon, and just take the leashes off him. He's a number five pick. You don't play safe with a number five pick. Just let him run riot. Let him do what he does, because it wasn't just the sacks. I mean, I can't remember. It was the running back, wasn't it, that he just absolutely leveled at the line of scrimmage? Was it Breeder or the other running back?
It was. He'd fitted up a gap, thought he was going to rip off 5 yards, and he just slotted straight into that gap and said no. It was great. I was listening to Jackson Bevan talking about Witherspoon today on the Cigar Thoughts podcast, and he said something really interesting. And what he'd said was he'd seen a lot of people since that game talking, a lot of big names talking about Devin Witherspoon, and he'd heard Sherman mentioned, and he'd heard. He'd heard Deion Sanders mentioned as well, about making the guy that he's covering disappear and making flashy plays and having that attitude about him and that edge. And he said that for him, the real comp for Devin Witherspoon when he plays the center of the field was Earl Thomas. And he said the reason he thought a young Earl Thomas was a good comp for Devin Witherspoon is Earl Thomas relied on instincts to put himself in. He'd read it. He'd instinctively move himself to where the offense were going to be going. And he'd often get there before the offense had got there and be there to instantly make a play and allow nothing. And how many times did we see Witherspoon, whether it was, you know, the ball hits the receiver's hands and he's just bang, lays him out, you know, making plays behind the line of scrimmage, you know, fitting the run play as well. Just, he puts himself so quickly in position to blow stuff up. Earl Thomas is a great comp. I think it's a really good comp.
It's a great comp. A corner the size of Devin Witherspoon should just not be leveling running backs like Matt Breeder. He shouldn't be leveling running backs standard. He shouldn't be leveling people that size standard. But he just loves it. He lowers the boom, and he's just such a throwback. And he's such a kind of. It's almost like they brought him in as a way to honor the Legion of Boom, because it's the 10th anniversary. Do you know, it just feels like they've thought, where can we find a thumping cornerback, ball hawking cornerback to almost echo and honor the Legion of Boom, and they found one in Devin Witherspoon, because he just reminds me of those days every time I watch him, and he's so good, and he's only going to get better as we keep saying. Linebackers, absolutely exceptional. I mean, Bobby Wagner, I don't need to tell you all how good Bobby Wagner is, but 17 tackles, 2 sacks. I mean, seriously. But John Brooks, because we all know how good Bobby Wagner is. We don't need to spend too long waxing lyrical on Bobby, even though we should, but it's just standard. Bobby is Bobby. We all know this. But Jordan Brooks, coming off that ACL to get 2 sacks, got 10 combined tackles. He also got the fumble recovery as well, and an 82.3 PFF grade from the game. He's still, when the injury happened and we got the time frame, he still really shouldn't be on the field. We all thought he still wouldn't even be on the field by this point, and he's played every game, and he's looked excellent in every game. I mean, shout out to whichever surgeon and doctor have worked on him over the summer and since his injury, because you need to go right to the top of your industry. because the guy looks like fucking Superman out there. I don't know what they're putting him.
It's almost like they've given him some upgrades, you know, instead of just fixing him.
He's exceptional, and I just thought he deserves a massive shout-out because, again, stuffing the run, Matt Breida only got 30 yards rushing on 14 carries. What did you make of the linebackers from that performance? Because they just keep getting better every week, as well as the cornerbacks.
Yeah, I think the game's been a bit simplified for the linebackers. Certainly, Bobby's job has been a bit simplified. I think they've allowed him to focus on the good things that he does, and I think they've removed some of the duties from Jordan Brooks, and they've allowed Jordan Brooks to do more of the stuff that he's always done well. So that's been really interesting to see, because you've just got two guys who are really potent at what they do, doing what they do best. And I think you're just getting a really good look at a Hall of Fame middle linebacker and a guy who's got all the talent in the world. Being allowed to just play downhill and just play to his strengths. I think they look superb. They look right in their element last couple of weeks.
Yeah, Jordan Brooks Hall of Fame or Bobby Wagner?
Let's say both.
Let's say both. I was thinking, does he mean Jordan Brooks? Yeah. Well, I mean,
here's a question back to you. Sorry, on Jordan Brooks. Then, with it being a contract year for him and us not taking the option, the way he started, can you see a world where we don't have him playing for us next year?
No. With all the cap space we've currently got, they've freed up that cap space. We'll carry cap space into next year. We'll see, obviously, what they do in terms of releasing guys. Maybe they move on from a Jamal Adams at the end of the season because that guy can't stay on the field. Quick mention for Jamal, like I say. Only he would wait that long to come back, get a concussion on the first series, and then he's back off the field again. That was the biggest anticlimax since the Barbie film. But I tell you what, if Jordan Brooks doesn't come back to the Seahawks next year with the way he started again, now the only thing that would throw this into question is if he goes down with another ACL injury. Then you've got to think, do we risk sort of, you know, paying him again after, if, you know, touch wood, he doesn't, but if he was to get another injury like that. But if he doesn't and he stays healthy, I mean, the guy looks even better. I mean, we all knew, especially Pez and stuff like that we preach on this pod, we're a bit of a Jordan Brooks fan club. But we all knew how good he was before that injury in his first few seasons with the Seahawks. This season, I think he's playing as good a football as he looks as good as he's ever looked for me. He looks even better than I've seen him. And getting two sack games and just not just the sacks, but the run defense and the dropping into coverage. He looks such a better player. It looks like he's used that kind of time in that rehabbing to really maybe go and study the game a bit more and study what he needs to do and work with the coaches a bit more. Rather than just being out there on the field all the time, maybe he's spending a bit more time, you know, being allowed a bit more time in the film room, working closer with coaches and stuff.
I absolutely know what you're getting at. I think there will have been with the character he is, with him not being able to be out there practicing, he will definitely have been in the playbooks, been bending the ear of the coaches. And I think also if you look at this from the angle of, this is kind of a two-pointed thing here. I was going to ask you this question, but I'll kind of answer it myself as if you'd asked me. Before he got injured, he had the green dot on the back of his helmet, which means he is the mouthpiece of the defense. Everyone's looking and listening to him to guide them and to make all the assignments and move people around. And I think that diluted him quite a lot. I think with Bobby gone and him being in that role, I know that's always going to be big shoes to fill. With the things Bobby did on the field before you factor in him organising that defence. He doesn't have the green dot on his helmet now. Bobby does. And Quandre Diggs does. I think they're the two defensive captains, aren't they, this year? Diggs and... Yeah. So those are the guys with the microphone in their helmets. Jordan Brooks is just listening and being pointed. You know, defensive coordinator's telling him what he's doing. Bobby next to him is telling him if there's any changes to that. And ball gets snapped and he's off and he's just... using his talents and his instincts in that moment. He's not having to look at anyone else or move anyone else around. That, I think, will add 10 to 15% onto anyone's game. Being able to just focus on what they're doing and not having to coordinate 10 other players, right? So there's that factor. But like you say, there's also the fact that he probably knew he hadn't done the best job of that. And he probably thought, well, Bobby's back this year, but I may well still be here when Bobby goes. And when that happens, I want to know our playbook better. And I want to be able to do that job better than I did it before. So there could be the case that he's relieved of those duties now, so it's helping him. And he's also looking at being better at it when, you know, when the dot's back on the back of his helmet. Mm. So there may well be a lot of homework going on in that time.
Yeah, that's a
wouldn't
fair
be surprised.
Point. Fair point. D-line then, this is an interesting one, because there's guys who are shining and there's guys who maybe are taking a little bit later to bloom this season. I'll start with a guy who's maybe taken a little bit later to bloom, because before the pod, you picked up on an interesting video of the Devin Witherspoon sack on Daniel Jones, or one of the sacks on Daniel Jones anyway, because, yeah, by the way, he got two. So the one where he absolutely lit him up from the blind side. There's an interesting look that you've offered and Matty Brown has offered from his podcast. So full credit to Matty Brown for the clip that we'll be playing on YouTube. But Daryl Taylor, no sacks so far this season in 5 games. Obviously, 9.5 sack season last year, 6.5 before that. Struggling to get involved in the backfield and on the stat sheet or the sack sheet so far this season. Is it a case of he is playing well, it's just not quite happening in terms of getting to the quarterback yet? Or, because I know you're a little bit conflicted on Daryl Taylor yourself, is he just not having a good season? Is he not playing well, or is he playing well but other people he's opening up other lanes for other people to play well because of his level of play?
There's a bit of both, I think. There's one thing with Daryl Taylor this year which has become quite obvious in a few games. I don't know whether you've spotted it. I've seen it mentioned by a few other people, and it's something I'd seen while looking at the tape as well. And that is that when he lines up, I think teams know that we think it's a pass scenario. Mm. And they'll often run the ball across him that way, because him being on the field means Boye Mafe isn't there, or Derek Hall isn't there with Nwosu on the other side. And I think there's quite a lot of run-pass option sort of scenarios where the quarterback will opt to bring the running back in and run it that side of the defensive line, knowing that he's not the best in run support. Mm-hmm. And that's not a slight on Daryl Taylor. It never has been the big part of his game. But there was one moment it wasn't in this game, it was in the Panthers game, where he dropped contain on Dalton at the same time. There was someone outside of him that had gone round to rush the passer, and his job was to keep the contain so that the quarterback couldn't you know, go on and keep the ball and run that side of the line. And he followed the quarterback as well as the player that was rushing, left his position and got completely burnt. Similar to the Witherspoon thing, where it was quite obvious where someone was at fault for a big play. Now, moments like that don't help his stock, because it further adds to the read that teams have obviously got on him, that he's not our best run defender and they can probably exploit it. So I think the jury's out a little bit on just how weak his weaknesses are. His strengths are as good as his weaknesses. You know, he's as potent a pass rusher as deep as the flaws are in his run game. So he continues to be a specialist player for us. I just worry that when we put him out there, people know that we're expecting it to be a drop back.
So I'm going to put that clip on here. Just walk us through what we're seeing here with Daryl Taylor. It looks like he maybe to the untrained eye, not the untrained eye, but maybe the non-expert eye, that he loses his rep a little bit. But just explain what Daryl Taylor is doing here.
So I'll set it up. I'll assume you've got this paused so people can see the positions that everyone's in. Feel free to draw any squiggly lines or arrows as I talk through it. So we're there in a very traditional bear front, or a bear nickel front, as it turns out to be. But it doesn't look like a bear nickel at the time of the snap. You've got three obvious linemen. You've got three techs, and you've got your nose tackle there. And on the snap, they're going to immediately engage the center and the two guards in one-on-one scenarios. And the bare front is designed to avoid the opportunity for double teams. So those two tackles are going to be left on an island, and the two outside linebackers are going to directly try to engage with those tackles. So the full offensive line and the full defensive line are going to be engaged with each other in one-on-ones. Luckily for us, we've lined up like this when they're in an empty set, meaning that they don't have tight ends strapped onto the edge of that offensive line to help out and pick up any other rushes, as it turns out to be pretty fatal for them. And the other thing to notice here is Devon Weatherspoon is lined up with a wide receiver on the quarterback's blind side. And after the game, they state that Devon Weatherspoon states that they'd noticed that Jones was taking too long looking at his first target, meaning that the wide receiver that he leaves to rush on this play would be looked at too late to notice that he'd been abandoned and was open. So you're now going to play this, I'm sure, and we're going to see immediately Daryl Taylor stunts to the inside, which pulls the tackle into the guard and leaves a huge channel for Devon Weatherspoon to run a straight line straight into the quarterback before he's had a chance to look at even his second read and has no idea that Devon Weatherspoon is coming. And it is an absolute thing of perfection, executed to the T by everyone, but especially Daryl Taylor, as making that stunt to the inside makes the tackle think that he's winning the play. He's got him controlled. He's pushed him into a pile. He's not getting around the outside of him, and he's won. But what he's actually done is been baited to the inside out of the way of Weatherspoon, who's had absolutely no resistance whatsoever. Perfection.
Perfection, like I say, it's an interesting look in terms of maybe not everything you see is how it seems. You know, Delta looks maybe there that he's losing his rep, but actually what he's doing is a very intelligent player call in terms of stepping inside. He knows Witherspoon's coming on his outside. He opens that lane up for Witherspoon, and bam, Daniel Jones gets fucking... He meets the turf monster. It is absolutely textbook. It's how they drew it up. So fair play to Daryl Taylor. He is showing signs of that he is doing things well. He's just not sort of showing up on the sexy stat sheet yet, but he is too talented of a pass rusher, in my opinion, for him not to. It's only a matter of time. But like I say, this emergence of Boye Mafe as a transition onto him is just maybe limiting his opportunities a little bit. What did we make from Boye again? Because another sack from him. His emergence again. As again, we don't want to blow our own trumpet, but we're going to. Predicted on this podcast that he was set to have a breakout year. We've said it all season that he's going to have a good year. He's going to sort of really lock down a key starting sort of three down role, if you like, for the Seahawks defense, and he's doing it again. Only the two tackles, but there's. But obviously you get the sack in there as well. What do we make from Boye from this game?
Yeah, I mean, he's doing exactly what we wanted on that edge for the majority of snaps in a game, which is a guy that can set the edge, stuff the run, and get pressures on the quarterback. We want someone like Nwosu on the other side who is solid and rounded in every facet. So we can bring a fresh Daryl Taylor in on pass rush scenarios to do that. And every other snap is a versatile defender on that edge. He ties in massively to the revitalization of our D-line. Without him there, it is a slightly different concept. It's a majorly different concept, honestly. But luckily, Derek Hall is a very similar sort of profile that can set an edge well and has the speed and agility to rush off the edge and create pressure as well. So we've actually picked up a really good cover guy for Nwosu and Mafe on both sides in Hall 2. So, Mafe's leaps and bounds a better player than he was last year in the respect that he's able to get pressure as well as setting an edge. Simple as that.
Mario Edwards is another one that we've talked about on this podcast in terms of what you specifically, a bit of a hidden gem, free agent pickup. Super Mario gets another sack from the Giants game. just a really talented player that's going under the radar.
Was it the strip sack that came from him? I feel like it was.
I think it was.
Yeah, pretty sure it was him.
I think it was.
It's a really big play.
Just making plays, going under the radar, but making big plays. He's proven to be a really decent contributor.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he fits the scheme really well. And as I kind of alluded to on the previous play when I said we were in a bare front and things, we lined up like that in a bare front last year, but we didn't really have great personnel for it. We didn't have an ideal sort of situation there. The key person there that was a problem in that was, in my opinion, Al Woods.
Mm.
Because Al Woods is essentially a run stuffing specialist, and you were needing someone in there who could stuff the run and create pressure. It's now Jarran Reed in there, and he's doing a good job stuffing the run, and he's getting pressure and wrecking games, as we saw against the Panthers. Mm. Suddenly that's working because you've got these versatile players, and Mario Edwards is exactly the same again. He's a guy who can stuff the run and he can get pressure. Draymond Jones, again, similar guy, can rush the passer, can stop the run. Exactly what we drafted in Mike Morris as well.
Mm.
And also I'll make the point with Cameron Young, as I said in the pre-draft process, he was a guy who was getting lots of pressure, wasn't necessarily getting the sacks for the stat sheet, but was constantly penetrating that line and getting pressure. So we've transitioned the whole defensive line now to be extremely versatile. And Mario Edwards might not have been an $8 million contract, you know, a year guy. He's almost vet minimum. But he just fits exactly what that line needed.
Mm. Yeah, he does. He's doing his job every game, going under the radar, and he keeps making plays. On the other hand, the guy that we did spend a lot of money on and people thought would come in and do what maybe Mario Edwards is doing is Draymond Jones. Only 4 solo tackles so far this season, 6 assisted, so 10 total tackles, 1 sack. You compare that to last season in Denver, in 13 games played, he had 47 total tackles, 24 solo, 23 assists, 6.5 sacks, and 1 forced fumble. I don't know. Is he just getting lost in what has turned out to be a really talented, productive D-line, or is he not playing as well as he should be? Is he not settling in? He's one of these people where, like we always say about the offensive line, if you're not hearing your name called, you're doing well. On the D line, it's a little bit of the opposite. You want it the other way around, and I'm just not hearing his name called.
I think he's doing fine, actually, and I think he might well be the reason that the smaller names are actually exceeding expectation. A lot of the time, your biggest weapon on the defensive line gets all the attention, and the other guys feast. You saw that for years with Aaron Donald, with players like Floyd. Getting sack after sack, whereas you put him in a team with a bunch of not Aaron Donalds. I don't want to say average player because no one really in the NFL is truly average. But in comparison to Aaron Donald, I think everyone is average. So sometimes your most potent and obvious weapon is a beacon for teams to scheme against. And in dealing with that player, they leave gaps elsewhere, and they hope that the less talented players don't find a way to beat you. And unfortunately, you're picking your poison at the moment with this defensive line, because all 3 guys can beat you one-on-one. And Draymond Jones he's had that one sack, actually. You mentioned his stat line. His stat line doesn't do him justice, because there was a sack opportunity in this game where he went straight through. And I think he was almost surprised by how little resistance there was from the Giants line, and he almost overshot the runway in going straight past Jones, but someone else picked up the sack. And there was another one where he got there and hit the quarterback, he'd stumbled out of the sack and then got finished off by someone else. So he was disruptive, he's hitting the quarterback, he's punching holes, he's attracting a lot of attention. He's just not getting those stat sheet numbers that we look at and make judgments on in general. And I'm not having a pop at you there for just picking up the numbers. Like you say, you haven't heard his name called much, and that is the first thing you look for. But I think he's doing a superb job. And as long as he's fitting in there, I think we'll see other people having a much easier game.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I want to talk about a point now in general, whether it's defense and offense both at the same time. That is, I don't want to end the pod on a little bit of a negative here, and I'm trying not to, but it's just an interesting thing that I've picked up on that maybe is potentially a reason why, obviously, it wasn't close against the Giants, but sometimes we stay in close games and allow teams to continue to get opportunities against us. And that's our penalties and the penalty yards that we're conceding. It's quite interesting when you look at the amount of penalties that we've conceded already this season. So I'll quickly run through. We had 7 penalties for 55 yards against the Rams in week one. Against the Lions in week two, we had 9 penalties for 80 yards. Compare that to the Lions' 4 penalties for 24. In the Panthers game, we had 8 penalties for 82 yards. The Panthers had 13 penalties, but for 82 yards as well, which I don't know how they've got that many penalties for less yards or the same amount of yards, but that's fair play to the Panthers. And then again, in this Giants game, as good as we were, as good as the defense was, again, 8 penalties for 74 yards. The Giants only had 6 penalties for 45 yards. What's going on with these penalties? Because it feels like we're playing smarter football than that. But the penalty yards sort of stat is quite damning week to week at this moment in time. Why are we giving up so many penalties? Forgive me, I don't know whether the majority of these penalties are coming from the defense or the offense. I would imagine more so the offense. But I don't know.
We've had quite a few. It seems like we've had quite a few offensive holding penalties, and we've had a few offensive pass interference things. There's been a couple on DK for ill discipline and it's a blindside block on something which was incredibly overzealous against the Rams, and there was no way on earth anyone was agreeing with his take on it. But I think in terms of the penalties, there's been a lot of holding. There's been some strange I think there was an illegal man downfield at one point where in the Giants game where someone had made contact 5 yards ahead of the line. It was a bit clumsy. But at the end of the day, if you told me we'd be playing with 4 backup offensive linemen and still conceding that few penalties in a game, I'd be quite happy with that. Let's not forget that... I mean, we all saw how many penalties were given up by the Panthers at our place with the noise. And we've played now away at MetLife and at is it Ford Field for Detroit? I think it's Ford Field, isn't it? Yeah, both of them, not very noisy atmospheres while we're on offense. And we weren't anywhere near as bad as the Panthers were with that. The holding calls seem to be being called... incredibly irregularly. I don't, and in terms of, you see awful ones like the one that we had while we were in overtime against against Detroit. I can't remember which one of our offensive line it was, but the hold was awful when Lockett scored his touchdown. That one wasn't given. The ones that were being given against us recently were, you see that on every play kind of holds. So. Yeah. I don't know. Some of them are throwaways. The one on Witherspoon. No, I'm not. And the one against Witherspoon had one which gave up a first down at a key point again. I think it was against Detroit. I might be wrong. I think it was Detroit. There was no way on earth it could have been a defensive pass interference. It was one of the worst decisions I've ever seen, and that one ripped off about 30 or 40 yards, I think, with where it happened. So the numbers can get horribly skewed by egregious decisions and things. I don't think we're doing too bad.
No, it was an interesting kind of. Is there anything to read into it? Like you say, you think of all the backups that we've got on offense and on defense at certain positions. Maybe they are doing better than what they should be doing.
Yeah, and one final thing on that. I mean, for 2 games this season so far, we've had 19 out of 56 players as rookies, which is an outrageous number. And this week we had 15 on the active 56 roster as rookies. So... Combine that. I mean, that's a quarter of our roster as rookies, through four games, and backups starting games on the offensive line, which is an absolute magnet for yellow laundry, the offensive line anyway. Add those two factors in, and I think we're doing quite okay, honestly. And that's something that, as the rookies get more experience, that will calm down. And as some of our starters come back as well, I think again we'll see that trend downwards. So not overly stressed with the laundry situation.
Good. Anything that we haven't talked about? Anything players wise? Anything in the game, players, or anything that we haven't touched upon that we feel maybe need a mention? I'm trying to think myself.
I think we're always going to miss things with this game because it was just an absolute circus of feast for the eyes defensively. Every single player on the field seemed to have his own at least five play highlight reel, apart from Woolen, whose highlight was the fact that they just didn't want to go near him.
No.
I did, if you'll afford me a minute of indulgence in our defensive line, I have written a little thesis on what the perfect defensive line looks like, and I'm just going to quickly read it for you and the fans, if I may. I see you've sat back and you've got your drink, slippers on, get the pipe, and the dog goes off.
And the dog's heard, you know.
So, the perfect line and what it looks like. A perfect defensive line for me would look like a top three run defense combined with the most pressures in the NFL. Check and check. That is where we sit as we speak, giving up approximately 3 yards per running play, which is third in run defense, and the most pressures in the NFL through four games at 98 in four games, which is astounding. So how do you get to a point where you're stuffing the run third best in the league and also generating the most pressures in the league? And my theory is what you do is you pick up defensive linemen that can do both to a good standard. Now, with Draymond Jones, Jaron Reed, Mario Edwards, Boye Mafe, and Nwosu as out there on run stuffing downs and on dropbacks, you've got five guys that can rush the passer and stuff the run. You're incredibly equipped to put pressure on if it's a keeper for the quarterback, and if it's being handed off to a running back, you're well equipped and well drilled to stuff the run, which to me means that you're very rarely caught out in a position where you've got the wrong personnel on the field to deal with whatever they're doing. It also means in an RPO situation where the quarterback's making a decision based on what he's seeing, we're well disguised in the backfield with all the versatile defensive backs we've got, and with players like Devin Bush as well, who is sometimes in coverage as a safety or the nickel, sometimes he's a linebacker. So we're very well disguised and extremely versatile with the personnel. I think that's essentially what we've been trying to put together. Like we said earlier, with Mike Morris being drafted as a defensive end that can also play in the center. That's what we picked up in free agency with Draymond Jones as well. Jaron Reed is a defensive end. Then he's a defensive tackle. Oh wait, no, he's actually a nose. You know, you look all the way across that defensive line. There, we've put together a group of guys that can cover each other if they're injured, can stay out there four downs in a row and whatever position we have to put out, depending on the look the offense is giving, we've got the pieces of the puzzle to just assemble it and be fit for purpose. That is a masterpiece. Honestly, it's a masterpiece. It's not, you look at that where we sit with pressures and run defense, that isn't a fluke, and that isn't as a result of who we've played. That's just the fact that we've assembled something that can react and be molded to whatever we're being shown by the offense. And that for me is what a perfect D-line looks like. It might also, we touched on Daryl Taylor earlier, and it might also be part of the fact, a part of the reason why we're looking at his stat line and it's slightly deflated in terms of where we think he probably could be. I mean, we wouldn't be surprised if he had four sacks at this point.
Yeah.
You know, we might also not be surprised because he tends to get his sacks in bursts, doesn't he? He'll have a three-game stretch where he bags five and then he won't have any for a couple. But in reality, I think with the way we've built this new defensive line, we're looking to give as many snaps as possible to players like Hall, who can, you know, run stuff and rush the passer. Nwosu, who's the same, and Mafe, who's the same. So he might be falling victim to not being as versatile as the other guys, to be honest with you. But just my take on it. What do you make of that?
I want to make the point that let's give our props to Pete Carroll in a sense, and not the way that you're going to think that I'm going to say. I want to give props to Pete Carroll for allowing John Schneider to remain with the Seattle Seahawks and build this team and help build this defense, help put those players in those positions and add those puzzle pieces to the puzzle. Because John Schneider was very, very close to leaving us for the Lions, interviewed with the Lions in 2021, if you cast your minds back and remember that. Obviously, Pete, at that moment in time, weren't drafting very well, weren't adding players to the roster very well, weren't doing particularly well in free agency. And Pete sort of, you know, was getting a little bit too powerful in the draft, in the way that decisions are made in terms of player recruitment, who comes in, who goes out. John Schneider obviously had a little bit of a falling out, goes and interviews with the Lions, doesn't get the job. Pete holds his hands up and says, okay, I see your point. I want you to stay here because I value you. So you're going to have more of a say now in the draft. You're going to have more of a say in the recruitment model than who we bring in. And since that point, we've nailed two drafts. I mean, we've just hit home runs in both drafts. Free agency signs have improved drastically in terms of the standard of players that we're adding to our roster through free agency, because we used to make some terrible free agent signings. But like it to transition into your point there in terms of building the defense, because that is Pete Carroll's specialty and stuff like that. I think a lot of credit has to go to him for not becoming too proud, because we do kind of call him out for that a little bit at times, being a little bit too proud, a little bit too stubborn. In this case, he wasn't. He realized that I need John Schneider. What I'm doing at the minute isn't really working. And since he's handed the reins to John in terms of player recruitment and adding those puzzles to the pieces, or adding those pieces to the puzzle, I'm getting my words in a fucking right old wrangle today. So that's my two cents in terms of, and I take everything that you said. Yeah, I think that the D-line, that they've just added, the, like you're saying, the non-sexy players, Boye Mafe's, the Mario Edwards's that we brought in, obviously bringing Jaron Reed back is a bit of a masterstroke. So I think we've really nailed it when I thought we hadn't. Like, say, I looked at these guys that they were bringing in, I didn't think they nailed it at all. Obviously, I didn't know much about Cameron Young. I thought Jaron Reed was over the hill. Draymond Jones was a lot of money. Like, say, Boye Mafe was an interesting prospect coming out of college, but he was far from refined, a little bit of a raw prospect. Derek Hall is the same, but I tell you what, they are starting to come together like jelly now. They are coming together, they're gluing together, they're getting better week in, week out, and that defensive front is all of a sudden, Nwosu as well, it's looking like a really scary unit.
Yeah, and one thing I was going to say is, when you look back now at how we drafted for the defensive line, you might have looked at it and thought, a nose tackle in round, what did we pick him up? Was it 3 or 4? Cameron Young.
I think it was 4.
4. So Cameron Young, where we took him, and then Mike Morris in the 5th round, or it was 4th round, 155, wasn't it? Or something like that. Crap maths. When you look at where we invested in the defensive line, it looked like it was an afterthought. But actually, when you look at it now and what they're building, this versatile defensive line, they picked really well for the scheme. And if you build, I feel like if you build this kind of defense that's versatile, can do a bit of everything, it's a bit of a jack of all trades, master of none sort of situation, where you could spend a first round pick on a pure edge rusher that got 20 sacks in 2 years in college, that is just a specialist at, you know, having his blinkers on and just, you know, beeline for the quarterback. But actually now, the way I would draft this year to improve our defensive line would be to get similar players. I find myself looking at college and thinking, well, which players are more run stuffing edge rushers that maybe have like sort of 10 to 15 TFLs and 5 to 8, you know, sacks? Because I feel like we want to be reinforcing what this is doing. Stuffing the run first, forcing the ball through the air to the DBs, and being able to dial up pressure with the same personnel that are on the field to stuff the run. It's completely altered my perception of what we want to recruit on the edge, especially, and also what we want to recruit in the middle of the defensive line. And I think that's a big vote of confidence to just how improved it's been, that I'm now looking at how we improve it and how we find similar players to back it up and add depth. So, I think it's been a resounding improvement, and it's been so good to watch. Their box office, and there's no real big names in there. What they've compiled and the way they complement each other has made it so exciting to watch.
It's not often when our offense goes off the pitch and the defense trots on that you're not looking forward. Like, I don't mind it now. I'm like, all right, cool. We get to see this defense again, and I'm excited.
Spoon.
Yeah, get to see some Spoon, get to see some Nwosu and all these guys going after people. And it's just, I'm enjoying watching the defense more than the offense.
It's almost like when it was the Legion of Boom and you wanted to see Cam Chancellor absolutely level someone, or Richard Sherman, you know, making a big play and getting in someone's grill, or Earl Thomas, you know, you name all those names. And I used to almost go off and make a cup of tea when the offense were on, and, you know, go and grab a biscuit and, you know, come back and hopefully we're three and out and the defense are back on when I get back.
Oh, we usually were.
I know we usually were, it was scintillating watching the Legion of Boom, and I'm getting so much joy watching this defense. So I'm not saying that it's going to be the same. I don't think anything ever will be. But the vibes are similar, and I'm absolutely loving that. If we get slightly more fluent on offense, we're going to be an absolutely superb watch for a neutral as well.
Oh, we're one of the most fun teams to watch in the NFL. If I can imagine, if I was a neutral and I'm deciding what games to watch each week, the Seahawks would be right at the top of my list in terms of what am I going to get in terms of entertainment value. Because we have got so many box office players on both sides of the ball. Quick look to the Bengals game before we finish for a few minutes. What we're thinking now in terms of, I'm a little bit more confident that our defense can handle the Bengals offense, because I must admit, I still look at it and go, I can't get past that it is the Bengals and it is on the road. And I know Joe Burrow is not Joe Burrow at this moment in time, but I can't see the Bengals staying as a one win team for much longer. They can't go like it, it, do you know what I mean? I feel like that they're going to turn at some point, and it just feels like it probably will be. It just will be the Seahawks that they turn on, because they just can't. They're just too talented on offense with Chase and all these guys, and Burrow when he gets healthier. I just can't be fully confident yet. Like, I wasn't going into this Giants game because it's the Giants on the road and it's just a tough environment, even though we've got sort of MetLife, we practically rent MetLife from them in terms of when we go there and beat them.
Home from home,
yeah. But it just feels like I can't be so confident going into a Bengals game. No matter how badly they've started, I just have too much respect for Burrow and that offense to be like, oh yeah, we're going to go in there and beat them. I'm not on that sort of train yet. We may well do that, but I still think this is just one of these games, like it's a trap game and we just lose it. But the defense have shown me enough in that Giants game that, look, I don't think we're going to get that kind of performance again. But that, you know, maybe I can't wait to see Tariq and Devin have a go at Jamar Chase and then Higgins. And so it's going to be a box office matchup. What are we thinking?
I on that last point, I think it's going to be really interesting to see who Jamar Chase thinks he's got the best chance up against.
I mean,
honestly,
I would say because Tariq is more his size, and obviously he can run with him. Devin's a little bit slower than Tariq, just a little bit, and obviously he's a bit smaller. So you'd have to think Devin, but I don't think he'll be lined up in the position
If they do, and we see Devin Witherspoon getting targeted that many times in a game, we're going to have a lot of fun.
Oh, we are.
We're going to have a lot of fun watching it. And what I wouldn't want to see is them just keep taking on Reek and them going sort of having a 50-50 thing. Sometimes, he receives it. Sometimes it's broken up, maybe an interception. I would rather see Witherspoon go toe-to-toe. And, you know, I think that's just going to be fireworks. But I think one of the things that could massively play to our strengths is if he's still pretty immobile with this calf injury, and they're showing no signs of resting him for it to get better. It seems like they're content to just manage it throughout the year. That's a horrible decision for me, because if they get him, if they get him fit in 2 weeks, rest him a couple of weeks, they can save their season. If they play two thirds of a Burrow for the next 7-8 games, or up to their bye week, whenever their bye week is, I don't think they're going to have a fully fit Burrow for the majority of the season, and it'll be a horrible underperformance from them as a result. The fact that they're having to protect him so much with their offensive line because he can't scramble at the moment plays immeasurably into our strengths coming out of that Giants game, where the defense, you know, were schemed up to keep penetrating and getting in there. Jones is far more mobile than Burrow is right now, and he got sacked 11 times. That's a horrible prospect for a quarterback they're trying to protect and get healthy. We are going to hit him multiple times in the game, whether they're sacks or just hits. He's going to get hit. And also factor in, when you are trying to protect your quarterback as much as possible, often your tight ends are in there as extra pickups for defensive linemen, not offensive weapons. And at that point, they're running their really talented receiving core into an outnumbered situation, into a really talented defensive back room that's just not going to be stretched by the numbers. So they're diluting themselves in a lot of ways if they keep putting him out there injured. Maybe he's better and more mobile by the time we get there. Like you say, maybe the timing of it works out massively and not in our favour. But I think as long as they're protecting him like that and he's immobile, all of our strengths become heightened.
I agree. In place of positive Pez, let's have a Mystic Mitch, because last week we got fairly close. I know Pez said a pick six for Tariq because it was his first game back, jokingly, even though I brought him up. And obviously Devin Witherspoon got one, so we hit the post there. I said John Brooks would get his first interception. Again, I've hit the post there because technically he did have the ball in his hands on a defensive turnover. It just wasn't an interception. It was a forced fumble recovery. And then he gets the two sacks as well. So he did have a brilliant game. So I hit the post a little bit with Jordan Brooks. I can't remember what his other ones were. He probably said JSN for 200 yards, which obviously didn't come true. Mystic Mitch, I want to hear a couple of your predictions in place of positive Pez.
Okay, so we are going to beat the Bengals. And I don't think that's the positive.
You've stood by that since our predictions. So
fair yeah, play. No, I at the time I said that our strength was in our defensive backs, which we're really starting to see flourish. Mm-hmm. And I think that we nullify them there and our offense beats their defense. And I think that's where this matchup, the tail of the tape in the boxing, you can often see how certain styles and strengths of different fighters line up in and favor one person who may not be the favorite on paper. I think that's exactly how this goes. I think where our strengths lie, their weaknesses lie, and they, you know, we match up really well with them. The fact that they've got injuries and stuff as well to key players only helps that. So I stick by that. I'm going to say, I don't know what I predicted on the prediction pod from memory. However, have you got it there?
I haven't got it there at all. No,
you went straight for your phone like you had me quoted, keeping receipts. No, I'm going to say we win by over a score. I think it's going to be about a 10-point victory, something like maybe 27-17, 25-15, something like that. My real positive Pez moment, or Mystic Mitch, as you call it, I looked at our next six games. I'm predicting we only lose one of those. It could well be our game after the bye. Perhaps it's not. But I really think we can be, I mean, what are we now? 3-1. We could be a 9-2 team. 9-2? Am I being stupid? I am. 8-2.
Ask me about maths ever, because I won't help you out.
Yeah, we could be an 8-2 team in six games time. That's good maths. Four games.
That is good, but I haven't got a clue if you're right or not.
8-2. I hope I'm right. I'd love to see 8-2. But yeah, no, I think we can go 8-2 over the course of the next 7 weeks because of the bye. And it won't massively surprise me.
Yeah, for me, it's going to be a massive sort of see where we are in terms of how confident I'm going to be. If the Cardinals can beat the Bengals this week, I'm fully on board that we're going to beat them. If the Bengals beat up on the Cardinals, then I'm like, all right, okay, maybe they're starting to turn a corner now. But if the Cardinals can beat them this week and Burrow look, and the same things happen again with the Bengals, I'm like, okay, maybe we will go there and beat them, and maybe we should expect to beat them. So it's an interesting sightsee this week in terms of how they match up against the Cardinals and whether they can play them close or not. But for now, and of course we will be back to talk about that game, whatever happens, as we always do on this podcast. But thank you very much for listening, as always, whether you get us on the YouTube version of our podcast or whether you are one of our OG listeners and you get us through the audio waves, wherever you get the We Talk Seahawks podcast, we are always as ever thankful that you do. As always, you can find us on social media, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, all that stuff. Just search We Talk Seahawks. We'll be there and waiting for you. You can find our Discord server, as always, and as our pinned tweet on X, Twitter, whatever it's called. You can find that on there. Just hit the link. You'll be straight into our Discord. Great little place to hang out and chat Seahawks with us. Also, we've got some fun things coming up in the next few weeks. And we've got some fun Seahawks games coming up in the next few weeks to talk about as well, starting with the Bengals next week. So let's go and get that 4-1. But for now, thank you very much for listening, as always. And go Hawks.
Go Hawks.